To get started, I'm Lucy Barber. I'm Deputy Director at the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, and I'm going to, at the very beginning, ask some of my colleagues questions. To my left is Ray Lefevre, who has worked at the New York State Archives for many years, involved with their various grant programs that go to their communities and archival repositories. To my immediate right is Joel Worrell from the Preservation and Access Section at the National Endowment for Humanities, and then Krista Williford from the Council on Library and Information Resources, but more notably part of the group running the Mellon-funded grants for exposing hidden collections. Hopefully that was half correct. So how we're going to run this is we came up with four initial questions that one of us is each going to answer, and then after that, we're going to turn it over to you. We really are going to be somewhat brief in our initial answers, and then we really do want you to, these were ones that we felt like were pretty common across the programs, and then there are, of course, differences among the programs. We're not, in the beginning, getting into any of the specific details of how much money, where, what, but you know, start asking, do whatever you want. I'm sure there's people in the audience that will have shared questions. So I'm playing that role of interviewer. So I'm turning to Ray, and I'm saying, Ray, so what should someone do who thinks they're thinking about needing money?
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't expected that question. But let me see what I can do. Okay. Sorry, we don't mean to be, but we do want to keep this kind of light because it is 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And can you hear me all okay through here? Okay. So in the ideal world, what you really should do is, you know, you've got a problem. You're identifying the problem. You're identifying the solution. You're not saying, oh, let's go for some grant money. That's the ideal. And I will talk about the ideal and I'll talk about the real. But basically, you have a problem, you look for a solution, and document your whole process in terms of how you identified the problem, what solutions you explored, why you rejected one solution and went with another one, because if you do decide to apply for a grant, that information is going to be important to the people reviewing your grant. So I think it's just very critical to do that. Do your homework, document your research, then look for a grant program that will fit the issue you're going to resolve. And I'm going to repeat this, I think, a number of times. Read the guidelines. It's just amazing sometimes how people come. I'm involved with two programs at the New York State Archives. We have one for local governments and one for what we call historical records repositories. And it's amazing sometimes how people just, they obviously don't read the guidelines because they ask for things they shouldn't ask for, or they're not even eligible to come to us. So anyway, read the guidelines. Make sure that the problem you're attempting to solve is something and the solution you're proposing fits with what the funding agency will fund. If you're not sure, then try a radical idea. Make a phone call. Send an email. Most funding agencies are willing to talk to you about what it is you're thinking about doing. We think it's a good idea because we don't want you coming to us if it's really the wrong, if you're barking up the wrong tree. We want to direct you to the correct tree. So, and like for instance, don't go to a program that doesn't fund conservation work to do rebinding or deacidifying. I mean, don't even attempt it. I think some people are kind of like, oh, well, you know, maybe they'll think about it anyway. No. If they say they don't fund it, they don't fund it. So, and if you feel like you are jamming a square peg into a round hole, you probably are. If you're really struggling to make the fit, it's probably not working. Maybe you need to go elsewhere. Look at what the program will fund. Does it have priorities? Some programs have certain priorities. They're looking for particular types of collections or topics or something like that. We do that with our Documentary Heritage Program. So look carefully at the kinds of things that will be funded. If you can't find a good fit, and I'm a little nervous about suggesting this, one of the things you may need to look at is, well, either you find another problem, or maybe the problem fits, but your solution doesn't. Maybe you're going to have to consider a different solution. I say that with some caution, because I think going to a grant agency with a solution that really, in your mind, isn't the best, I think makes it much more hard, makes it harder to write a grant. So, but think about in terms of that. We had a situation years ago with one of our local government applicants that wanted to microfilm records, and they wanted to create their own service bureau. They wanted to film, process, duplicate, the whole nine yards. We had advised them during the course of their applying that, okay, that's not specifically disallowed, but you really should think much more strongly about using a service bureau, because you're neophytes at this, you know, you don't know anything about running a service bureau. Go to a service bureau, at least for your first project, so you learn more about how the whole thing works. Well, they did it, somewhat reluctantly, but by the end of the project, they were like, this was the best advice you ever gave us, because they saw how complicated microfilming could get. So, and that worked out very successfully, so I was very happy about that. Now, as I said, this is all the ideal. You have your problem, you find a grant for the solution. Sometimes the ideal isn't there. Your boss says, hey, here's a grant, get me money. Right? Yeah. Well, you have to kind of work around that. Most of what I said still applies in terms of identifying your problem, identifying your solution, does it fit or not? You may have to, in some instances, go back to your funding, your mucky muck, your high mucky muck or whatever, and say, we can't do this, it doesn't fit. That's kind of hard to do, but you have to be prepared to do that. So, and again, read the guidelines. I can't stress that enough. Make sure that the grant program, make sure what you're doing fits with your mission. Sometimes people will come to do a grant project, but it doesn't really tie to anything else they're doing. That's problematic. You really need a project that's going to fit with your organization's mission. And then, can you handle getting the grant? I remember a local government a number of years ago, you got full funding on your grant. She goes, oh, I got full funding on my grant. And then she goes, oh, I got full funding on my grant. She just realized that it was an awful lot of work. So be prepared for the fact that there's no free money. At the minimum, you got to work to manage the project. Number of grant programs actually want a cash match. They want an in-kind match. They want some kind of match on that. So in terms of deciding whether you're going to apply or not, look at that. And just make sure that ultimately you're going to have the time to manage the project successfully. You don't want the project to crash and burn. That's going to hurt you in future applications.
Thank you, Ray. That was perfect. Now, I realize that with my slight caffeine deprivation, I forgot to tell everybody an important fact, which is that at the back, thanks mostly to Krista's great design skills, there are bookmarks which have a, Ben will show them off to you, which have a URL where we've sort of combined a lot of the things you're going to hear. I mean, we're not all going to repeat the things that we've written, but we've all written certain things that are answering these questions, and then some questions that we thought people might ask, but we didn't want to say them, but you can still go check it out. So it's on the actual CLEAR website, but the URL is back there, and it's really pretty, and it looks like this. So, and look how green we are. It's the new world. So now I'm going to turn to Joel Worrell from the National Endowment for Humanities and say, so Joel, you've made that deep commitment. You've thought about your problems, and now you're going to write a proposal. What should you do?
What to do next? Before I answer that, I just want to mention a couple of things. I want to thank Lucy for organizing and proposing the session, and thank the program committee for approving of it, and to thank all of you. This is really a remarkable attendance. And even though we are taking this kind of light approach to it, I don't want for you to mistake that as frivolous in any way. We understand what you're all going through right now, and it hasn't been that long since I've been out of the business of on the other side of the table, so you know, grant writing's been something I've been responsible for, too, and it's not easy. So that said, I also want to follow in the spirit of the grant writing exposed theme and to expose the identity of one of my colleagues here in the audience. Jen, can you stand up, please? Jennifer Cerventi, who is a program officer in the Office of Digital Humanities at NEH, is here as well, and has helped to assemble the handouts and bring them to. And she's available to answer questions about that particular program. So how to do a proposal? Well, there are full workshops that are presented on this, of course, so capsulizing this in 5 minutes is a tough thing to do. But I'm glad that Ray set the stage for this, because the metaphor that I like to use for proposal preparation really is and in keeping with baseball season, is that of the major league pitcher. It wasn't long ago that the Washington Post ran a piece on Steven Strasburg, this phenom, who we won't be able to see tonight if you're going to the game. He's going to pitch tomorrow, but he throws 100-mile-an-hour fastballs. And they spent a lot of attention on the mechanics of how he delivers that pitch. And it has so much to do with everything that happens before his arm goes forward. And I think that's really absolutely correct, everything Ray has said, that you know, you need to spend that kind of upfront time laying the foundation for identifying what you want to do, doing the research on the various grant opportunities, spending much time with the guidelines, and using that time in some cases to inspire ideas. I fully agree that you need to ideally come up with what you need to have done and then look for the resources. But sometimes that search for the resources allows you to be a little creative too and to identify things that you might not have thought you needed. There's a synergistic relationship there. And then reading sample applications too. Many of us provide those. We do at NEH. We provide links to successful proposals online. So that's a great way to get to know the process too. So then the delivery itself, what do you, you know, need to take into consideration so that you're, you know, throwing strikes and not wild pitches so much? So just a few things here. Again, as Ray said, follow the instructions. They mean what they say. If we ask for 20 pages, please don't give us more than that. If we ask for 5 pages, please don't give us more than that. The guidelines in our case, and I think in everyone's case, provide a structure, a framework for how we want you to present the information. And again, it's really what we want. And it's to the advantage, too, of the reviewers who we bring in to look at the applications, because they see so many of them and they really tire of proposals that stray from the prescribed template. So do follow directions. Pay attention to the evaluation criteria. They mean what they say also. And in our case, because we're the National Endowment for the Humanities, that H word is always paramount. We really do want you to address the humanities significance of the activities, the resources, the audiences that you are proposing. But also very important, of course, is project execution. So you'll see in everyone's guidelines the kind of criteria that we present to our evaluators and say, this is what we want you to look at when you're reviewing proposals, and we want you to know, as applicants, what those evaluators are going to be looking for. Keep in mind the distinction between claiming and demonstrating. It's a subtle distinction, but I think it's a really crucial one. I think the most competitive applications are those that can make that can cross over into that realm of demonstration. And what I mean by that is, for example, if you're presenting an arrangement description project to us, rather than discussing the importance of the materials and claiming their value, talk about how they've been used. Bring in some testimony in the form of letters of support or quotes from researchers. If they haven't been used very much because they've been unavailable, you know, at least address the issue of pent-up demand. You can find ways to talk about how others have informed you of the significance of this material so that it's not just you speaking, but others are helping bring that argument across. I would say also play to strengths and not to weaknesses. Progress and excellence always trump need and deficiency. And this we see, I think, in our most successful proposals, that they really speak to an institution in forward progress. The fact that you need something, that there's urgency, is almost a given, because that's why you're coming to us. And we just don't want you to dwell, and our reviewers don't want you to dwell on things that you haven't been able to do and can't do, because it simply starts to drain their energy as they're evaluating the proposal, and it looks like this is a sinking ship rather than something in forward movement. And in that sense, too, I would say backlog is a dirty word in most cases. Don't use that. Now, Krista may disagree, since she's dealing with the issue of hidden collections. But what we found with our evaluators is they say, this is an institution that has a backlog. Why aren't they dealing with their backlog? When I'm coaching applicants, I try to get them to recast that in different ways. We sort of take for granted that you've got some materials in abeyance and need to deal with those. Keep in mind that you're speaking to both specialists and informed non-specialists when you're writing proposals. And this is tricky because you need to reflect that you know your chops methodologically and in terms of the subject areas perhaps that your collections or materials or activities deal with. But at the same time, others are going to be reading this proposal who don't bring deep methodological expertise or perhaps that don't bring deep expertise in the subject matter. So you need to be able to kind of present that balance and to speak to both types of audiences. Don't obsess over budgets. And this often surprises people because they assume that, we and our evaluators are sitting at the panel table with our calculators and doing this, and that's not true. And in fact, we really don't want our panelists to be doing that. We really dissuade them from it. A budget is a plan. It's not a covenant. And what we try to remember is that if an award is made, there's a great likelihood that things will be adjusted in midstream, and we're going to talk about that a bit more. So don't spend a great deal of time counting pennies on your budget. Take advantage of services to review drafts if those are offered. At NEH, we do that. For most of our programs, if you provide a draft up to 6 weeks prior to a deadline, we'll review it. And I'll send you comments or talk to you on the phone about them, or someone else in our program will. Edit and copy edit, and then do it again.
And then have someone else read it.
And then have someone else read it. Misspellings, typos, they matter. Some would say they shouldn't matter as much as they do. But again, when panelists are reading 15 to 20 applications, some of those sort of scream out at them when they're in abundance. And then finally, if rejected, and it will happen sometimes, it certainly happened to me when I was in the grant writing business, don't manifest your disappointment recklessly. please don't go to the social networks and discuss your feelings too much about that. We are on the social networks, and it may come back to bite you. It might not, but it might. But I just think you might want to be careful about that. We've seen bad cases of that type of thing haunting applicants. But in the resubmission process, I will say that a large percentage of those who resubmit do succeed. And one of the reasons for that is because they've received the benefit of the peer reviewers. They've gotten the comments. They can interact with us again. They can tweak their proposals. And often, they come back with a much stronger proposal the next time around. So, several things to keep in mind. We could do more in a day-long workshop.
Thanks, Joel. Okay, we did want to have a little bit of focus on what happens if you are successful. Because we are exposing all of grant making, which also involves the side where you get the money. We know that many of you are probably going to ask us more questions when we open this up in about 9-10 minutes, so don't worry, this isn't the end of it. But I am now asking myself the question. So, Lucy, I got a grant, but things aren't going right. There's something really wrong. Our good planning, our attempt at a budget, it's not working out right. What should I do? So I just want to really encourage, and this happens, I mean, I don't know how many of you have been on grant projects, but it's not uncommon for grant projects to end up having things happen that are completely unexpected. People leave. In recent years, we've had a number of very strong fiscal downturns. All of a sudden, what you thought you had as resources don't exist anymore. the worst possible thing to do in the minds of grant agencies. And I do want to say we all did have a phone conversation. I'm not sure if we ever have the phone conversation, but we had a lot of email about this session. We all agreed, don't stay silent. Sometimes I get the sense that sometimes, like, certain management people will think, let's just not say anything. We'll fix it later. We'll fix it. We don't have a report for 3 months. By then, we'll have it all sorted out. Bad idea. The sooner you come to whoever your program officer is and say, look, this is what's happening, the sooner we'll start helping you and counseling your options. And I really encourage that. We, especially on the federal government side, we have certain legal obligations that we have to meet, and in a sense, there is a agreement when you accept the grant about what you're going to do, but those agreements can be adjusted if everyone is in the loop. So you have personnel change, you think you're not making the amount of cost share that you committed to. You really just can't keep doing the project in the way you discovered that, like, what you had estimated as a processing rate is just not going to happen, that those middle boxes, the ones you didn't sample, are a true disaster. Come and talk to us. Call us up, send an email, start that process. The more that kind of alert, the more we can adjust and switch to make sure that the project has the best chance of success, or just help you figure out, well, maybe this is what you want to try. I mean, I can give one very short example of a museum in California where literally they let I think more than 50% of their staff go. And they called me up and said, look, we just have to stop this project. And I'm like, huh, really? You know, that's too bad. Are you sure you want to make that decision right now? Like, you could wait. You know, maybe this person was, like, not from the archives program because basically almost all the archives people had gone. And, you know, maybe you want to wait. Have you considered thinking? Partly because they were in this stage where the work was going to be really lost. Like, you know, the finding aids were almost done, but they weren't posted. And I was like, well, what if you took 2 months and called in your former person and asked them some advice, and then we could rework it, give you extension? And it worked out. I mean, I just got a report from her. We're done. The finding aids are posted on the Online Archive of California. They were able to pull someone back on the project who unfortunately had lost another job. So, I mean, this, I know all of this is not what you want. None of these circumstances are making you feel happy necessarily. Some of you are probably remembering difficulties. But really, from our perspective, I think I can testify, we want to know about them. And often we, unfortunately, have heard of such things and may have suggestions that you haven't thought of for your thinking sort of cataclysmatic. And we're thinking, no, you know, we actually made an investment in you. We want that investment to pay off. So that's my very short plea, that if you get the money, stay in touch with us, even if things aren't going quite as expected.
Can I just interject? And the sooner the better, even if you think maybe you're crying wolf, I'd really rather you cried wolf than wait till after the three little pigs have been eaten up. It might be that, well, we think there might be a problem here. Call us sooner. We can strategize with you on having a plan B all ready to go. Now, if it doesn't happen, hooray. But if the crisis does happen, you're ready to go. So the sooner the better.
So having had that slightly on the side of having an award, now I wanted to turn to Krista and say, so Krista, what would you advise an applicant who's received a grant and now is having great success and things are happening? What would you like to hear from them?
Actually, the advice is the same. Stay in touch. We in the grants community really depend on the success of our applicants in order to keep our programs going. And this is particularly true for us at CLEAR. We're answerable to the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for everything that our awarded projects accomplish. And any good news you can share with us helps us that much more. We are also, all of us, producing various websites, publications. As Joel said, we're on the Twitter, we're in social media, and we want to tout your accomplishments more than almost anything else that we want to say. So it's the same advice. Keep in touch.
And do it early. Like, you don't have to wait for the next report deadline.
No, anytime.
Send the press release, send the news article. Our bosses love it. So, just like your bosses love it, our bosses love it. So,
I wanted to make one interjection back to something Joel said in the discussion about reviewing drafts, and this is specific to the two programs I'm involved with in New York. We're not allowed to review drafts because our state comptroller's office sees it as a bid process. So we just need to give the caveat that check and make sure. A lot of grant programs do review drafts and take advantage of that, but unfortunately in New York, once you're actually writing it, you can always call with some specific questions, but we can't actually sit and review your draft. We used to do that, and we were advised that, no, the state comptroller's office didn't like that. So,
and the same is true of the Institute for Museum and Library Services. Their general counsel has told them that they can't review drafts. Again, they will take questions and respond to questions. And they, of course, could have been up here, but we started to be worried about somebody falling off the platform. So we didn't really purposely exclude anybody. But
I should say also about the drafts issue, we at CLEAR, there's Amy Lucco. I didn't mention her. She's got her hand raised now. She's my colleague, and she and I are the whole staff for our grant program, and we simply don't have the capacity to read drafts for all of the people who would want to send them to us. But we have instead instituted a pre-proposal process with our review panel. So you have to get your application in early, but you will get some helpful comments before that final submission deadline.
So we are actually going exactly according to our secret plan, and it is now 8:30, and we wanted to open it up to questions. And I see the woman in the front. We are being recorded, so I will repeat the questions, or one of us will repeat the questions into the microphone after they're asked.
And it would be helpful if you identified yourself, too,
yeah.
Please.
Well, my name is Kim Edwin. I'm a library technician at the wonderful Library of Congress, and I do have to put in a disclaimer. I'm not speaking to anybody officially at all, and I'm new to all of this, so please, don't quote me on anything.
No Twitter right now.
So I am getting different information between what I'm reading on.
That does not produce documents. Can you elaborate on that? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
I'm sorry.
Kim from the Library of Congress was asking to clarify what she has understood as a discrepancy between written information and verbal information as to whether or not our agencies or other agencies can support federal institutions. And she indicated, for example, libraries that do not produce documents. And then I was asking that question, if she can elaborate a little bit on what she means by that.
Well, if I knew more, perhaps I wouldn't need to ask the question. But Library of Congress, that this you can take to the bank. Their Preservation Directorate program is fabulous. Mm-hmm. Global experts. Could not possibly be better, except there's only a few number of them with very limited funding that is, we have more needs than they can possibly provide at this time, obviously. And this part, don't quote me on. But I've heard that our budget may be cut overall. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure which areas. So I'm trying to explore
right.
this other possibilities.
I mean, I will say that we explicitly have been prohibited from funding federal agencies after some sort of political thing where we used to have sort of a nominal exception for the Smithsonian, and even the Smithsonian was eliminated, that our explicit mission is to fund the non-federal records of the, in some cases, it is federal records that make up our documentary editing part of our mission at the National Historical Publication and Records Commission. That's the firm policy at the NHPRC, and I don't think we've ever funded anything at the Library of Congress except for in terms of projects that collected manuscripts there for editing and then publishing.
Federal institutions are also excluded from our grant opportunities as well. However, that said, we have entered into, in the past and currently, interagency agreements with entities of the federal government, and specifically right now with the Library of Congress. You're probably familiar with the National Digital Newspaper Project or program. And if you're not, take a look at Chronicling America. It's becoming a wonderful site with a lot of content. That's being done on a national level, and it involves a cooperative relationship between NEH and Library of Congress, and then grants that are provided to individual state applicants. So that's, in a sense, an exception. The other thing I'll mention is that materials produced by federal repositories can work their way into grant applications from, say, consortial institutions. One of the types of programs or projects that we enable support for are what we call virtual collections, where some consortium or institution is developing a digital archive and they're using resources from a variety of repositories. Some of that material can be from the Smithsonian, Library of Congress, National Archives, for that matter. But it can't be exclusively those institutions.
So, yeah, I have better news. We actually, in the Cataloging Hidden Special Collections and Archives program, awarded one of our first grants to the Library of Congress Maps and Geography Division. We're the eligibility requirements for our grant simply state that you have to be a nonprofit organization with 501c3 status, which the Library of Congress does have a 501c3
Foundation, yeah.
So you can qualify under those circumstances.
So another question? Hi, in the back.
Hi, my name is
Amelia Askari.
I'm a master's student.
So Amelia asked a question about the prospect of how to handle multiple sources of funding. One question seemed to be applying for perhaps funding from multiple agencies for a similar project or applying for more funding for a related project.
We've run into that occasionally when people come to our program and they'll say that part of their match is they're hoping to get an NHPRC grant or an NEH grant. And that, to us, is problematic. Right? We really think, at least in our program, we kind of want to know you have the money in hand. And I really think the thing you want to be really careful about is these projects have to stand on their own. Maybe two of the funders will come through and two of them won't. And we've run into situations once in a while where it's obvious that if they're unsuccessful in one place, then the project's going to fall apart. And our reviewers generally are like not going to want to make that approach. So I would advise some caution there. And also, just for your own sanity, I think, you know, really, when you're dealing with multiple projects and you kind of start getting confused over what pays what, and you want to make sure that you can really manage multiple projects. I mean, we do it at the New York State Archives, and we have to be careful because it's a challenge.
I would say that it's good to we have no problem on the issue of multiple applications. Indeed, often that's sort of a myth, I think, that people have out there that they shouldn't be applying to the NHPRC and the NEH or to CLEAR. I mean, it's happened. People are doing it. I would say please rewrite your application. I'm afraid that we open an application and we can tell when it's been just submitted to the NEH, and I suspect we'll become equally able to analyze a clear one when we refamiliarize ourselves with the opening questions. So each ones have different guidelines and different questions, so don't just recycle. It really doesn't, you know, it both doesn't make sense to us on the first read and then to the peer reviewers. But it isn't a problem except for until you get the money. And when you get the money, there does have to be a clear distinction that there are different needs being met. What Ray said about when you're looking for other sources, particularly outside sources, I mean, I think probably the NHPRC has that happen, where people are looking for fundraising. We will sometimes make our grants contingent on you demonstrating that you've received that funding or have a promise of it. Because we require a cost share, and at least NEH, I don't think, does anymore, and I don't know about.
No, we don't require. Mm-hmm.
But this might be a good one for you guys to weigh in, too, on.
Sure. Like NHPRC, NEH doesn't have a problem with your pitching your application to other funders. In fact, we in many cases expect that that's what's happening. So that's not a complication. But I would echo what Ray said about for your own sanity. For example, it is difficult to juggle multiple applications, and that it is important to make sure that if you get an award from any one institution, that it can be a standalone project. That you're not, you know, trying to mix in a way that one is interdependent on the other. And in our case, in terms of cost share, yes, it's not a requirement at NEH, though we do have suggested guidelines with respect to cost share. And this is really speaking to the issue of competitiveness more than necessity. Our evaluators and we appreciate applications from institutions that show significant amounts of skin in the game, I guess you could call it. Federal money from another grant agency is okay to use as part of your cost share. It does need to be resources in hand, though. I think it can't really be a prospective grant out there that you're looking to get. But third-party cost share contributions can be from any source.
We don't accept NEH cost sharing. It can't not be in the budget. It has to be our guidelines. The regulations are very specific about that federal sources are not acceptable. So don't make that mistake, and that can be a real problem. So just so.
And it's interesting, you're hearing interesting nuances of difference, and I'm glad some of these questions are coming out, because inevitably you'll encounter these kinds of things as you go further into the grants process.
The only thing I would add is that I have seen this multiple simultaneous projects situation work successfully with one of our first awardees for our program. But in this instance, it was just as was described, two related projects, but that stood independent of one another. So, in fact, when subsequent to being awarded our grant, our recipient received an additional grant, that was sort of leverage they used to change their project plan with us in a way that made both of their proposals ultimately better.
And one last thing. Again, this can kind of confuse panelists when they see this coming through in applications. Lucy mentioned that we're starting to receive proposals, of course, that we can understand come from other institutions, and the term hidden collections is creeping into our grant applications more and more. There's nothing wrong with that term at all, and in fact, we prefer that to backlog, as I mentioned before, or hidden treasures, for example, is a wonderful thing to say. But yeah, as you said, don't recycle. Make sure you're speaking to that particular program, which may have different requirements in many respects.
And read the guidelines.
The gentleman in the back.
If you have a rather large consortium project,
So the gentleman asked, I'm sorry, where are you from or your name? Carleton, a gentleman from Carleton College asked about if there's a consortial project that might be both eligible for the NEH and for the CLEAR Hidden Collections Grants, would there be an opportunity to get the two programs together to talk about them?
My guess is no, that wouldn't work. We're kind of a slave to our calendar. The number of hoops that we have to jump through, the number of different administrative tasks that we have to do in order to process applications take up most of a calendar year. And we also want to leave some time for people to actually write their proposals. So what you're describing, I think, would require us to be a little bit more flexible than I think that we could be. That said, consortial projects for our programs certainly, and I would imagine for other programs as well, are very attractive. So if you can conceive of this larger project in a way that kind of chunks out to independent use, so you have a cataloging part that's good for hidden collections that you could still accomplish if even if you didn't get money for digitization, for instance. I would really support, you know, going for it, even if you didn't know, you know, from the beginning that you were going to be able to accomplish the grand overarching goals that you have.
Really ditto to that. I think that's an excellent answer, and the idea of seeing your initiative in ways that could address funding opportunities from multiple agencies is a great way to think about your initiative and to make it manageable. At the same time, I agree with Krista. We really couldn't take an individual application and work together to see if we could sort of mix and match the funding. There have been opportunities where, for example, we and IMLS have collaborated on grant programs to make a competition available, a call for proposals, and where we've joined forces in funding those, but as you say, partly because of the calendar, we can't sort of take an individual project proposal and collude.
Yeah, I think there's also the sort of, to use the word, collusion problem with that.
Yes.
That and the review processes each are going to be different. So I saw another hand up just before. Oh, there. Hi. Can you introduce yourself?
Stephanie George from California State University. And I'm wondering if you could address some of the fundamentals that you expect to see in place at an organization before, you know, what are kind of the red flags that would throw something out immediately? For example, someone applying for a preservation and access grant before they have their environment under control, those kinds of things.
Oh, yes. Stephanie from California State University Fullerton asked about environmental, about what are some of the sort of fundamentals that you need to have in place in terms of applying for a particular different grant. One example being, what about environmental controls before applying for a preservation and access grant from the National Endowment for Humanities?
I'll start. I mean, that's an excellent example of the kind of thing that definitely would be a red flag if it's not demonstrated, and I like Joel's use of demonstrated. But for instance, we have a situation sometimes where someone will come to us for arranging and describing a collection. They don't own it yet. That's a problem, you know? It's kind of like... sometimes there's ways we can work around that. We've had some interesting projects that have been collaborative where one organization had the records, they processed them to give them to an archival, and that was fine. But we've run into problems sometimes where the custody is not clear. And to me, that would definitely be a red flag, I think, probably for any of our programs, if the custody of the records is not clearly delineated. And it may be there's a very good reason why the organization doesn't have custody yet, but they need to explain what that good reason is.
I would add, too, again, it depends on the program, but another red flag often is intellectual property complications. If you actually not only don't own the physical materials, but if there are or issues regarding access in some way, that you have restrictions on the material, that might be a red flag. It often is. I think you raise a good point about the environmental sort of assessment, depending on the program. Again, we have a newer program right now at NEH called Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections. And this is a program that resurrects, really, and builds upon a previous grant category that was called Sustaining Humanities Collections. And it addresses issues of macro-environmental and sort of macro facility concerns and needs, things like HVAC systems, fire suppression, security, in order really to compete for the higher level awards in that grant program. You really do need to show that you've gone through the planning process and the assessment process, and we offer that type of support through our preservation assistance grants for smaller institutions where you can bring a consultant in. We also have a planning grant within that Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections program, too. So I think that was a good example that you raised in posing the question.
I would add that one example that we often run against is whether or not institutions have the capacity to have regularly scheduled hours. We're reluctant. The NHPRC takes a certain pride in often helping archives open. Actually be established to start, but we often want to see as one of the outcomes during the course of the project is to move from a sort of appointment-only schedule towards a regularly scheduled open hours for access, and also about charging fees for access often raises red flags with reviewers and with the commission in general, just to make sure that people have, the right to research without a significant burden on them in terms of getting there. I mean, of course, we understand the sort of offsite storage and all that type of thing, but moving in that direction. And again, I would really echo what Joel said earlier, is that in preparing a proposal, whether it's that you have made efforts to address it and you don't hide them. You don't leave it for us or the peer reviewers to know, that place, last I heard, that place was falling down. Didn't it have a fire? I'm sorry, that's an extreme example, but I don't even think a true one. But I mean, it's to not, if you lay it out there, but you say, we've taken these steps, the university's making this investment, this is happening for our, grants, there might, it might demonstrate that the institution, the repository is moving in the right direction. And rather than the plea of patheticness, because we do fund some quite small repositories, we're familiar with the plea of patheticness. It isn't always that compelling. It makes us sad, but, it tends to make you also wonder, move forward and, what could you have been doing? Maybe you should have been moving those boxes rather than writing the grant proposal, frankly. So
I would just echo in our case, these issues of capacity are also important. Making your collections or having the ability to make your collections accessible to scholars is sort of a critical bottom line for us, for a reasonable number of hours. The ownership of the collections is something that has to be absolutely made clear. In some cases, too, when our applicants have expressed the desire down the road to digitize a collection that they want us to fund the cataloging of, we don't fund digitization, but they don't have the rights to do so, that may give our reviewers pause as well.
Woman towards the front.
I'm Gail Mongrie from the Tamanan Library at NYU, and actually we've done pretty well grant-wise, but I live in New Jersey, and following on some of these really
Gail Mongreen, who works at New York University but lives in New Jersey, raised the question about what about the sort of sorry, my eloquence. Do you want to say it?
I thought it was a good question, Gail.
Can you repeat it first?
Yes, yes, I am. her question is that in these economic times, with these organizations facing cuts, what can we do just in terms of, I guess you're thinking of in terms of sustainability. I mean, these organizations, they're trying to do an important mission, but, they keep getting cut. I know New Jersey had a great grants program for local governments. It's just gone. It just disappeared. And they're closing libraries. I think what's interesting is something, and particularly our program, our Documentary Heritage Program in New York State, which NYU has been very successful with, we have been encouraging for a number of years. We would get grants from organizations. It was almost kind of like a Judy and Mickey, let's put on a show. It's like, oh, we're an organization, let's create an archives. And we'd be kind of like, could you think about that? And particularly with the wealth of repositories that are already in New York. And so I think one of the ways to deal with that issue is going to be more collaboration. I mean, we talked about that issue earlier. And actually, I know there's a woman here, Hannah Chanstein from the Buffalo Jewish Education Project, is doing a wonderful partnership with UB. In terms of the fact that here's an archival institution that already has the infrastructure in place, so she's working with them as she identifies records of the Jewish population in Buffalo. We think it's a wonderful example. They did not go out with, let's create our own archives. We found a partner. Now, I realize what's hard in terms of the question you're asking is some of these institutions have archives, and they're losing the money, and they're losing the support. I still think, some collaboration, some partnership, it might be a way to sustain them till times do get better, because times will get better. I really like to think that. That may be one of the ways to go. It's tricky sometimes, because sometimes, I don't know how it is with the other granting agencies, sometimes I think people will come to us because it's like, well, we're losing money, so we want your grant money to fill that hole. That's really hard to do. We generally don't put in money that you were once expending and then it's gone. We're just not in a position to replace it. So it's not the best answer other than, I don't know if you can get your governor to change his mind on the Paris grants anyway, because that was a wonderful grant program and it just disappeared. Our program is holding on, but we know it's hard. It's really hard.
It really is hard. And we talk about this a lot in the office and try to figure out ways that we could possibly address this type of concern. Infrastructure is crumbling in many institutions and closing of libraries and such. When an institution like the Arizona State Library and Archives has to lay off like 10 of their 13 staff at one point, and I know there's been some return.
In a brand new building.
In a brand new building. You're in a really difficult economic climate. But I think Ray's right. Strategies such as partnership and collaboration are going to be more and more important. We funded this past year an interesting project from a small public library in our large grant category, our Humanities Collections and Reference Resources, the Massillon County Public Library of Ohio. We did, yeah. They have this extraordinary collection there of family papers that go back to colonial times, and their project was to partner with the Ohio Historical Society and the Ohio Memory Project. So that was appealing on various levels to our panelists, and it wasn't a great deal of money that they were requesting either. It was a modest ask, and it just looked attractive. So that's there. There are opportunities for smaller institutions, and again, our Preservation Assistance Grants Program is a good way to sort of get on that ladder toward infrastructure development, too. If, for example, you do a consultation or an assessment, you come away from that project with a report that serves as a tool, an instrument that you can take to us, other funders, and say, it's not just us talking about this. This expert came and gave us this assessment.
We'll take that last question, and then I think we promised Ben Primer that we'd finish on time, and I don't lie to Ben because he has a big weird hat on.
Dean of the Boston
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I missed her name, but from Boston, a person from Boston University asked a question about having the donor provide a letter of support in terms of a project that where there may be some comp. Oh, you're the owner. Okay. Right. Right. So, but having the donor's support for making them more public and accessible, I think those types of letters are very are great, along with other types of letters of support and proposals that to make materials available. I mean, we definitely are always that those are good letters to include to make it clear that it, on a personal level there's an impact, but then also the scholars' letters and other people who might make use of them.
We had a specific case in point this past application round in humanities collections and reference resources we support. Is anybody here from the University of Massachusetts by any chance? Rob Cox or anyone? Yeah, the papers of W.E.D. Du Bois are there, and it was the same thing. David Du Bois, the son or grandson, I believe it must have been, has the inherited the intellectual rights to that material and was providing documentation of his support for the project and to make it publicly available.
So I think we have to finish. I want to remind everyone that we have the little bookmarks that has many of these things, different hints and other hints that are at the back, if there are still plenty of them on. I think several of us left handouts about our grant programs on that back table, too, that you can pick up. Joel has already identified Jen, if she's still here. My colleague, Alex Lorch, is in a green shirt there. He looks like he needs his coffee, but I bet he can still talk. And feel free to ask us questions.
And actually, my colleague, Pamela Cooley, is our DHP grants officer for anyone from New York. And I am so impressed that this many people came at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Wow.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who have served as reviewers for us as well. We always want to make sure.